Then if you're ready to proceed, we are ready to proceed. We'll remind you that we have a timing system that you self-monitor. If you want to save some time, however, for rebuttal and want me to help you watch the time, I'll try to do so if you'll let me know that right now.
Okay, that would be fine, Your Honor. Perhaps 3 minutes.
I will turn yellow when you have 5 minutes.
Okay, thank you.
And I'll try to keep in mind 3 minutes, although we don't have that up here anymore.
You're right there.
We have a new courtroom, getting used to everything here. Okay, we're ready to proceed if you are, counsel.
Okay. Well, good afternoon. I'm Cynthia Mardian, registration number 13356, and I'm appearing for the appellant, defendant appellant Charles Ellis. Your Honor, there's actually four arguments in the briefs. I'm going to put my emphasis on argument number two. As the Attorney General's pointed out, arguments numbers 1, 3, and 4 really would only require a remand for a correction of the minimus. They wouldn't require certainly no new trial and no change in the sentence, just a correction. Under argument number two, it would actually be, we'd be requesting a reduction in his sentence. So I'm going to put my emphasis on that, although I'm prepared to go forward with the other three if you have questions. On argument number two, essentially what happened here is that there was a change in the statute. In this case, it was a sexual abuse case. The allegations covered a 3-year period, and there was a change in the statute during that 3-year period, specifically in 2002. And the change in the statute was that prior to 2002, the amendment then, any pattern crime had to have occurred prior in the 10-year period prior to the predicate offense. After 2002, that was abolished, and it just had to be within a 10-year period, but not prior to. When the jury instructions were being considered, I don't think they were really aware, either the judge or either counsel were really aware of that change in 2002. There was a reference by the judge that that because everything had occurred within a 10-year period, it really wasn't necessary to do any kind of instruction about a 10-year period. But nobody spoke up about that it needed to be prior to the predicate crime, prior to 2002. So
let me ask you a question there. Isn't it the case that that defense counsel did speak up? In fact, when he was asked by the trial court judge about the discussion of that 10-year period, he responded, "That's fine, Judge. I don't think it's an issue that's going to likely arise in this case."
Well, yeah, I guess he spoke up, but he did not raise this issue as being an issue that needed to be addressed.
Comment or approval by counsel invoke the invited error doctrine with regard to that instruction?
Yeah, I think the invited error doctrine, and I wasn't prepared on that, so I can't cite you to specific cases, but I think what it applies to is if an attorney is aware of an issue and decides not to address it. It doesn't apply when an attorney just is not aware that, basically this is more in the category of being ineffective. I don't think the attorney was aware that it needed to be a 10-year period, or that the pattern crimes needed to be during that 10-year period prior to the predicate crime. I think he was simply unaware of it, which doesn't come within the invited error doctrine.
But what leads you to that? Simply unaware.
I think any competent attorney would have argued that if he had been aware of it. I mean, I'm not saying he's incompetent, but I'm just saying I don't think he knew that, and thus he didn't argue it. I think he probably would have argued it if he had thought about it. Okay. So I don't believe invited error would apply in this case. I think, and basically the Attorney General's conceded in her, in the answer brief, that the jury wasn't properly instructed, that because the predicate, because the district attorney there requested a predicate crime that was in August of 2001 before the amendment, that that was a predicate crime, and that to have a pattern offense, it had, the pattern offenses had to have occurred in the 10-year period prior to August 2001, and so they weren't properly instructed. And I think that's a given, that they weren't properly instructed here, given the change in the statute.
Wasn't predicate crime the assault that occurred in the Ellis bedroom?
Yes.
I think that was what was on the verdict forms.
Yes, and that was August 2001.
And that was August 2001.
Yes.
And the victim did testify, didn't he, that there was sexual contact in, I believe, in Oklahoma in May of 2001, which would have been obviously prior to August 2001 and within 10 years prior.
Yes, Your Honor. I think there were... There was one after the August 2001 in 2002 when his younger brother was born, and then he testified to two instances where they had taken trips to Oklahoma. He had taken a trip with his grandfather to Oklahoma, and I believe it was May 2001 and May 2002. I know it was May of those years, and he did testify to that, and then he testified to some instances later on in Alabama which were actually not charged. So there was, I believe, just the one prior to August 2001, which was Oklahoma in 2001.
Subsequent events that the prosecution was trying to use as part of this pattern, subsequent to the predicate act here?
Yeah, there would have been testimony on the 2002 when his brother was born, and that occurred at the family home. And then there was in Alabama after 2003, after the family had moved out of state. And then there was a second fishing trip to Oklahoma.
Your position that this was plain, the instructional error was plain error?
No, Your Honor, I'm arguing that it was structural error. And the reason for that is I would rely on Medina versus People for that. I've cited that in both the opening brief and the answer brief. Medina versus People was a Colorado Supreme Court case, which basically looked at a very similar issue to this. In that case, the defendant had been charged with a felony five, and actually she'd been charged in the indictment or in the information with a felony four, but when they went to trial, everybody proceeded under the theory that it was a felony five. The jury was instructed that it was a felony five. When they came back, they found her guilty of a felony five, but she was sentenced to a felony four, and it was actually by a different judge. Perhaps the first judge was sick or something, I don't remember for sure, but it was by a different judge, and she was sentenced to a felony four. And in that case, there was no objection by defense counsel when she was sentenced to the felony four. And in the And at that time, the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals found that it reviewed it under plain error standard and said that it was not plain error because essentially there was no, the difference in the factor was not disputed. It was whether she knew that her boyfriend had actually committed a crime when she was assisting him. And the Supreme Court came back and said, well, that doesn't make any difference because it's structural error.
Is it your position then, if it's not structural error, it's also not plain error?
Your Honor, and that's what the Attorney General's argued in her brief, that this should be decided under plain error and that it is not plain error. Your Honor, I would just again refer you to the Medina case.
Oh, no. How about we ask the question? The question is, if we were looking at this under plain error for some reason, would it be plain error or not? You know, we'll look at the Medina case, but aside from that, if we were looking at this under plain error, would it be plain error or not?
Your Honor, I think the argument is that it's, if to argue for the other side, it's not plain error because there was Mr. Ellis at trial did not dispute one of these, say, well, I didn't do the instances in Alabama after the predicate crime, but I, and not dispute another one. He just, his, he had a general denial to all of them. And so the jury would have found that he was either guilty of all of them or not guilty of all of them. And Your Honor, I think that's really comes in the category of speculation, because we don't know what the jury found. There was no interrogatory to the jury to say that they were finding the August 2001 as being the predicate. Well, I guess the way the jury verdict form was, it would say the August 1 was the predicate crime, but there was no interrogatory saying, when did you find the pattern crime? Was it prior to August 2001 or was it after? So if the court were to say this is plain error, the court would just be speculating as to what the jury found. And in sentencing that...
If it was mere speculation, is that plain error?
I think Medina makes it very clear that a sentencing judge cannot change... you have to go with what the jury found. You can't decide, well, we're just going to assume that the jury meant this, and so we're going to sentence him to a higher... basically, this is a sentence enhancer here, and so we're going to apply the sentence enhancer here and sentence him to a higher felony, because we assume the jury found that. And I think Medina makes it clear that that's not okay, that, you know, this is structural error in the sentencing phase, and that you can only sentence to the just to the felony four and not to the felony three here. I'll reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Bailiff? Stop the clock, please.
Ma'am, could I ask you a question, Ms. Marty?
Counsel?
Yes. I do have a question on your first issue about the failure to charge the sentence enhancer.
Mm-hmm.
Is it your position that the failure to charge the sentence enhancer would have violated, say, the Apprendi case, and that the prosecution's attempt to apply a sentence enhancer to count, I guess, three, would be a constructive amendment? Is that your argument? I'm trying to get my hands on your argument.
No, I think it's more that because they failed to charge that the trial court did not have the jurisdiction to sentence Mr. Ellis to the pattern offense when it wasn't charged at all in count one. It wasn't count one, I think it was count three, but it's argument one. But it wasn't charged at all. And so the court never had the jurisdiction to sentence him on something that wasn't at all charged.
May it please the court, Wendy Ritz, registration number 17024, representing the people. I'd like to briefly touch on the first issue before moving on to the second. In preparing for this argument, I reread the Medina case and realized that it had some analysis in there that was helpful to understand the first issue presented here. The defendant asserts that the information was not sufficient to charge the pattern count as to count three. And if you look at the face of the information, I think it clearly puts the defendant on notice that he was facing a pattern count, but it is not listed specifically under count three. However, if you look at the proceedings that occurred from the start of trial, the prosecutor from the beginning proffered instructions relating to count three as a pattern count, started opening statement by discussing pattern three as a pattern count, or count three as a pattern count, the verdict forms, everything from then on presented that as a pattern count with no objection, no surprise, no expression of dismay, nothing from the defense. And I think this acquiescence in the course of the proceedings to me suggests that essentially the information was amended in the process of the trial. And I think if you look at the Medina case, I noticed that in that case there was an ambiguity in the charging document. They weren't sure if it was a class four or class five felony. And the court points out that the prosecution cleared up this discrepancy on the first day of trial when it indicated it was charging him as a class five and proffering the jury instructions. And there's a footnote that goes on to say, Notably, this ambiguity did not prejudice Medina because the prosecution proffered a jury instruction that indicated they're going on a lesser class of felony on the first day of trial. The jury instructions provided Medina with adequate notice of the offense. So essentially, I think what happened here is what happened in Medina, and it was not directly presented in Medina, but the court certainly implicitly approved of the process and found essentially that the defendant was given adequate notice. And I think that's exactly what we have in this case.
Let me ask you a similar question when I ask opposing counsel. Under Apprendi, isn't a sentence enhancer supposed to be charged?
That's true. However, if you look at cases like the Cotton case, it suggests that sort of error is subject to plain error review. Cotton directly dealt with Apprendi. In that case, there was a defect in the information. The sentencing enhancer was not presented in the information, and the U.S. Supreme Court found that did not rise to the level of plain error because the evidence was overwhelming on that count. And I think that's what we have here also.
Well, we kind of do, and that does get us, I guess, into the instructional error issue. And I take it you're arguing it's not structural error, and you're also arguing it's not plain error, even though we really can't tell whether the jury would have relied on acts before or acts after this predicate act. Is that correct?
That's true. I think that is a problem, and that there was no interrogatory. However, I'll back up and say clearly we think Medina is not controlling here. This is completely different from Medina. Medina related to structural error in sentencing and clearly distinguished that from instructional error during trial. What we have here is not structural error. It falls under the plain error analysis. And given the way the evidence came out at trial and given defendant's lack of objection, what happened did not rise to the level of plain error. This was not a case in which the defense tried to pick out distinct types of contact and say, oh, well, I had an alibi for that, or I wasn't present for that. They did not differentiate between any of the sexual contact that was alleged. Their defense simply was that his story is kind of inconsistent and he delayed in disclosing, so therefore we think he's not credible. So their defense did not go to any particular contact. And if you look at the cases that deal with unanimity, like Thomas and that, which I cite in my brief, those cases make clear that there can be instances in which the way the evidence is presented and comes out, there is no really reasonable way for the jury to disagree about what happened. Either they're going to believe the child or they're not going to believe the child.
Right, but we're not worried about a unanimity instruction here. We're worried about the reasonable possibility that they could have selected an act after the predicate act as the basis of their enhancement finding, aren't we?
But I think, given the state of the evidence, if they agreed, they clearly found the predicate act. And if the jury found him guilty, given the way the evidence came out, there's no really reasonable basis for us to think that they found, well, we found the fishing trip in 2002, but we didn't find the fishing trip in 2001. The evidence was essentially presented in the same manner. The cross-examination did not go to timing. They didn't say, oh, there wasn't a fishing trip in May of 2001. There was nothing questioning the timing of the fishing trips. That testimony was essentially uncontroverted. And their defense went more broadly to either he's credible or he's not. And I think given this evidence and the way the case came out and the lack of objection, I think this court can say with assurance, having reviewed the record, that they either found them all or they didn't, which means that they would have found the May 2001 incident. And they clearly found the predicate act of August 2001 because that was specified on the verdict forms. I alternatively argue in a footnote that there was an August 2002 episode that he differentiated right after his brother was born. And if that were considered the predicate act, we wouldn't have any of these problems. I mean, I guess the problem we have there is that the prosecutor, unfortunately, did not specify that. But that's sort of an alternative approach I've thrown in for the court to consider. But I think it really boils down to we either believe this child or we didn't. That was their defense. That was the way the evidence came out. And if there had been cross-examination on when was that fishing trip in May of 2001? Did that really occur in 2003? Or everybody else in the family went on that trip, so we know nothing happened because we're all there. There was nothing to distinguish that from the rest of the sexual contact. And I think on this state of the evidence, that's enough to get us there. It does not rise to the level of plain error. If there are no further questions, I would ask the court to affirm the defendant's convictions.
I have a question about the minimus. The defendant claims that the minimus should be corrected because of the
as to count two,
count two consolidation issue. But I'm in reviewing the minimus, it looks to me like the minimus says that defendant class four, count three.
Four felony should be a class three felony if it was based upon
sentencing.
Do you agree with that?
Well, I would view that as just sort of another technical problem that had in this trial. I don't think that in itself is controlling to say that this means that what happened at trial sort of disappears and what we really meant was a class four. The jury clearly returned a verdict on a class three pattern. So I think that is more in the nature of a technical defect.
I'm asking, do you agree that the minimus should be corrected to indicate
yes,
a class
assuming
three?
That the court finds that the instructional error and informational error were not plain, I would say then yes, it would need to be corrected to correspond to the class three.
Let's go back to this. Charged as a class four, but the jury finds acts which would constitute a class three, and you think that the minimus should reflect a class three. Isn't that essentially what Medina is about? When Medina rejects the Rokunko analysis, isn't that a structural error?
It might be what Medina was about if at sentencing they had all said, we're sentencing him on a class four. At sentencing, they all agreed that that's what they went with the verdict. The defendant made no objection. The verdict was returned on a pattern count. At sentencing, they all were viewing it as a pattern count.
Lack of an objection doesn't make much difference in a structural error issue, does it?
But I think this is very distinguishable from Medina in that the court was imposing a sentence that went with the jury's verdict. The fact that it's reflected differently on the minimus, it imposed the correct number of years. The parties all viewed it as a class three, and I think the PSI presents it as a class three. And I think it was just a mistake. And I don't think that puts it into the category of Medina at all.
So I thought, and maybe I'm incorrect about this, but I thought Medina was you charge one offense and you sentence for a higher offense.
And this,
which is what occurred in this case. You charged a class four and you sentenced for a class three. And if Medina says that's a structural error, why isn't this a structural error?
Because the verdict in Medina was not returned on the proper count. Here the jury was instructed on the proper count and returned a verdict on the proper count. The jury returned a verdict on something that was not what the sentence was imposed for. Here the court, in imposing the sentence and imposing the term of years, imposed it for a class three. It was written on the minimus. I have not looked at the record for a while. I don't think they talked about it as a class four. I'm not sure how it got recorded on the minimus. I'd have to go back and look. But I think it is distinguishable in that it appears to be more a slip up post-sentencing, recording it on the minimus, as opposed to here we are at sentencing and we are imposing sentence for a verdict that is different from what the jury returned.
And here the jury returned a verdict for class three.
Yes.
And you're saying that's the difference between this case and Medina?
Yes, the verdict and the sentence corresponded. The fact that the minimus has an issue, I think, is a separate correction of the minimus problem and not the same as Medina.
Verdict and the sentence corresponded. The verdict didn't correspond with the charging document, but you're saying that incongruity is a plain error issue.
Yes.
Not a jurisdictional issue.
Yes, under Cotton. And You know, in looking at this case, it was very frustrating because it seemed to me that at some point they all sat down and said, count two, we're not taking to trial. Count three, we're going to charge it as a pattern. It seems like that happened, but unfortunately, it's not on the record. If that had happened, I would be up here saying that was invited error. It's not there, but I think if you look at the way it proceeded from the start of opening statement, instructions, verdict forms, that's essentially what happened, and the defendant acquiesced in the process. So that's why I think it's not plain error.
Acquiescing in the process gets you quite a far along the line of invited error, but it doesn't get you all the way home unless you've got a strategic reason for perhaps acquiescing, at least under the Stewart case.
Exactly. That's why I did not argue this as plain error. I'm saying it does not rise to as invited error. It does not rise to the level of plain error. I think it approaches invited error, and if they would have presented on the record more clearly what they were all thinking, we might have it, but on this record, we don't have it. So, but I think the way the evidence came out and the way the defendant clearly knew what the charges were, he was not surprised, he was not hampered in presenting his defense, it does not rise to the level of plain error. Are there any other questions? I would thank the court and ask to affirm the defendant's convictions.
One of your questions was regarding Washington versus Rukuku. I'm sorry, I don't know how to say that, but I'll just go with Washington. I think in that case, basically that was a case where there was an interrogatory that said, was this a deadly weapon and that versus an armed weapon? And in one case, they would have a sentence of 3 additional years, and in the other case, 1 additional years, and that was not distinguished. The Supreme Court decided that should be reviewed under plain error. I think the Supreme Court in Colorado made the decision that they were going to not consider, or they were not going to follow the Washington case, and instead they were going to find it structural error. And in footnote 6 of Medina, what they argue there is that they felt the dissent in the Washington case was by Justice Ginsburg was more illustrative of what should happen, and she argued it should be structural error. And the Colorado Supreme Court in Medina followed Justice Ginsburg's thinking that this should be structural error and not plain error. You know, where basically the jury's verdict doesn't really tell you whether they're finding was it a deadly weapon or whether they. I think it was it a deadly weapon or a firearm in that case? Here, was this a pattern or not? The jury verdict doesn't tell us in this case whether there was a pattern crime or not as the law stood prior to 2002. And I think under Medina, this court really must apply structural error and find that he was simply not convicted on that pattern account. And then I would be requesting that his sentence be reduced to show a conviction under a felony 4 as opposed to a felony 3. Thank you. If you have no other questions, thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The matter will stand submitted and opinion will issue in due course. The court, that being all of the cases we have on this docket, the court will stand in recess and the bailiff may so announce it.
Yeah, I know.